My name is Millie. I'm born and bred Dutch. I lived there until the age of 19 and then just scarpered, just didn't know how fast to get away from that place, the Netherlands.
Why? most people think of Holland as quite a, you know, the Dutch is quite friendly. Holland is quite a, yeah, quite a free country, really.
To which my reply always is, you try and live there for 6 months and then we'll talk again. It's the whole the culture just doesn't suit me. That's it in a nutshell. I'm a very, I hate hypocrisy. I detest, keeping up with the Joneses, you know, it's a hugely snobby place. The Calvinism, so Calvinism is the official state religion with the monarch head of the church, exactly like the Anglican church. Calvinism demands that everything is toned down. So you never show your sorrow. You never show your happiness. You don't dance. You don't sing. You don't dress, you know, exuberantly, flamboyantly. None of this is Dutch. And it just doesn't suit my character at all.
So how long have you been in the UK?
Since 1983. On and off, I have to say, on and off. I keep leaving here too, thinking, no, there's greener pastures elsewhere, and I keep coming back here. I love Britain.
And for some Brits, I mean, they would be surprised at that, and they think, well, actually, Britain is quite a hypocritical country. What would you say to them?
It depends whether you talk about the system or the people. My experience of British people is that they are very clued up, very awake, very anarchistic. You know, they've all got a line, and then they will, like the French, British people will protest at some point. You know, you try and mow some trees down or whatever, they will come out of their houses and show the government what's what. Like the poll tax riots taught me my activism. You know, it was just remarkable that people who were quite highly placed, like police constables and heads of school, actually took a stance and went, I will not pay this. I can afford it, but I will not, because it goes against the grain.
Yeah, I suppose it's standing up for your principles, isn't it? And I know you've been very active over the last few years, particularly with the freedom movement since the COVID pandemic.
Yep, I have indeed. Just saying no. No is very empowering. You know, once you learn to say no, you know, you have to take the consequences on the chin. But saying no is incredibly empowering. Anti-fracking also, you know, doing a lock-on, you lie there with your arm in a metal tube. Myself and a merry band of of layabouts and ne'er-do-wells, we locked down Eddie Stobart's in Daventry. That's their central distribution hub. And this 40-ton truck came towards my head, which was a bit of a scary moment. You know, it's like, please stop. But once it did stop, I'm lying there. And until I said that truck didn't move, Tesco's UK didn't get supplied on that day. You know, you hold all the power, and
I mean, that's a very risky business to do that sort of thing. What is it about fracking that really, you know, made you put yourself in that position?
The destruction of the planet, and it was quite an intentional attempt in the UK to destroy the last beauty spot. Every single fracking license was granted in either a national park or an area of outstanding national beauty or a site of special scientific interest. You know, that's no accident. And the same happens across the world. In all the indigenous lands, all the fracking takes place in the pristine last remaining bits of nature. And it pollutes, fracking pollutes air, land and water, and for very little gain. And anyway, there are alternatives. Why would we do this when there are so many alternatives?
Yeah, I can remember looking at the Nazis doing their shale gas experiments when they completely run out of oil and they didn't have anything to drive their tanks. That's how desperate they were at that point, right at the end of the war, where they started exploring this technology. I mean, I don't think we're quite there right now, but it may be that the oil supplies to the Middle East, et cetera, get cut off if there's some sort of conflagration. I mean, I suppose you would class yourself, would you, as an environmentalist?
The words become associated with eco-fascism, hasn't it? And with climate change.
Well, okay, so what's the difference between you and them?
I just follow my own love of Mother Nature, protecting Mother Nature, living lightly on the planet. And it's also to do with anti-capitalism and anti-corporatism, especially. You know, I don't want to give my dollar to the corporations, but I do have to live. So I forage and I plant. I do guerrilla gardening. There's all kinds of, you know, things that you can do without being an Extinction Rebellion activist or without promoting. I don't fall for the climate change narrative one bit. The whole CO2 story is purely because CO2 can be measured and therefore taxed.
But this is a little bit like, you know, talking about Europe as the EU. You know, this is conflating two things, really. Europe is not the EU. It's a continent, some of which countries are in the EU and some of which aren't. You know, you seem to be saying that climate change is some sort of, you know, well, I mean, it's quite obvious that there are climate changes going on. We just heard this week about in Bolivia, Lake Titicaca drying up. No water left there. So the climate is doing something. So what is it that you've got against the XR and the zero carbon people?
Well, I think I think exactly the same as the people who during the pandemic, you couldn't argue with them, could you? You couldn't say, look at this evidence. Here's quite clearly Fauci is lying. They were so hypnotized. So in the mass formation psychosis of the fear mongering and what have you of that machinery, you cannot reason with them. You cannot show them different answers, different solutions, you know, attempts at changing things other than what they proposed. So it's very much a cult for me. You know, it's a cult following, not true what we would call eco warriors.
Well, look, they see people like you who drive around using fossil fuels, petrol. You know, your bus, for example, as part of the problem. And ideally, they would like to make sure you're not allowed to drive around. You may have to get an electric car or something like that instead.
Well, let me point out, my bus runs on vegetable oil, not on fossil fuel. I think there's you can argue about all these things. There's a remarkable amount of evidence showing the most environmentally friendly vehicle is an old banger that no new metals need to be mined for, that no new lithium batteries need to be created for. You know, just drive these old bangers and try and make them as light in their consumption as possible. That's the answer. But yeah, ultimately, come on, we've had hydrogen engines for 200 years. You know, it's 200, nearly 200 years or more even that the hydrogen engine was first invented. Why are we not allowed to have that? You know,
Didn't you say something about your vegetable oil engine? That sounds interesting.
Well, actually, you mentioned the Second World War and Nazi Germany running out of fossil fuels. The engine of my Mercedes Vario was actually designed to run on rapeseed oil because there was no fossil fuel oil. So it's eminently suitable to just burn plant oils. So I've had it converted because the last thing that you want to do, if you can run any diesel engine. Jeremy Clarkson said it on Top Gear, any diesel engine can take vegetable oil and you can mix it like 40% oil, 60% diesel roughly, but you will wreck your pump and you'll wreck your fuel filters over time. So I've had it converted. I've got like a preheater and I've got a separate fuel filter, etc. So it's a very delicate, robust system. And I've been running on it for 40,000 kilometers now.
And so what do? You get your fuel from the supermarket?
Yeah, literally. Yeah. Well, not anymore. Not right now because it's become so expensive. It's, I think, £2.20 per litre. ever since Clarkson came out with that beauty on television, you know, the price of veg oil just shot up. But when I can afford to, I've tried to run on chip fat, you know, used oil from a chippy, but that's already lost its integrity, shall we say, you know, through being heated up over and over again. So my engine really didn't like it. And I'm not about to knuckle my engine for the sake of the planet. It's worth six of one and half a dozen of the other, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there is a problem here. We know with people being told they're going to have to get rid of their gas boilers. There seems to be almost a never-ending list of things that we rely on that we're not going to be able to use anymore if we want to save the planet.
Well, exactly. Do you know what? If these people were sincere in their attempts to save the planet, you know, between what are those things called? Parentheses, brackets. They would put in place the measures that are known to create a better environment. That's plant trees. Plant trees, first and foremost. Trees attract rain and hold water in the ground. Trees in urban environments cool the urban environment. What we are all living with is what's called urban stress, and it's too much tarmac, too much hard surface, not enough trees and greenery. The greenery cleans up the PM2.5, you know, the fine particles from pollution. So they would put in place green roofs, you know, subsidized green roofs, instead of chopping down trees, which they're doing everywhere, not just in the UK, in the Netherlands, Germany, France, everywhere. Huge amounts of trees are being chopped. Why? To make room for these high-rise developments that in the UK go under the guise of student flats. Well, where are all these students coming from? And I don't believe a word of any of this. So, as I said, what they're doing is they're putting in place the control mechanisms, forbidding all kinds of things, and putting the electronic barriers into the 15-minute city plans, the low-traffic neighbourhoods where, you know, where healthy behaviours will be the norm, as they say, and not the measures that actually make for a more pleasant living environment and a healthier environment.
Yeah, I mean, we are undergoing a bonanza of student flats here in Bristol at the moment. I wonder, what were you saying about those? So you think they're not for students? I mean, we've got more international students every year, particularly from China, coming to Bristol University. So what's that about?
Well, that's about money, obviously, because they pay big time. But obviously, well, in tinfoil hat land, it is surmised that the flats are for people coming from the countryside. So everybody's being driven out of the countryside. The Dutch farmers, through punitive measures supposedly relating to excess nitrogen. In Ireland, there's a new law that's driving farmers out of business. Here in the UK, I think farmers are encouraged to take early retirement. So there'll be fewer and fewer people actually living in the countryside. And of course, they will have to go somewhere in the cities. And I imagine that we are going the same way that China. We all saw during the pandemic, all these Chinese people just cooped up in these blocks of flats. And I think that's what's in store for us, possibly. Don't you?
Well, yeah, maybe. Who knows? I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like a long-term thing for students to be coming backwards and forwards from China for the next 100 years. It's a bit concerning. But I mean, you know, you're talking about growing trees. That's happening. A lot of private equity firms, hedge funds, etc., are buying farmland now to plant trees. This is for the carbon offset schemes.
Yes. Private, you say. Privatized. Yes. Yeah, the carbon offset, that's another huge lie. I'm not an expert on it, but it's not what's needed at all. And, you know, all the answers that I mentioned, they are there. Cities like Ghent went pedestrianized maybe 20 years ago. Breda in the Netherlands, Portland, Oregon. There's a brilliant TED talk called Walkable City. And walkable cities are just the answer to everything. They are much nicer places to live in than these, you know, highly polluted. So I'm currently in Leicester, and Leicester has got some of the worst air pollution of entire Great Britain. And some years ago, when I still lived here, say in 2017, I think, Leicester was spending £7 million per year cleaning air pollution off buildings because they're trying to style themselves as historic city ever since the discovery of Richard III's bones and the reburial. And so there's all been all this pretty paving put in place and it's now historic city, right? So they used £7 million of ratepayers' money to clean the air pollution off the buildings. Meanwhile, they keep building new roads, meaning new roads come with increased traffic volume. That's an absolute, 100% correlation. The more roads you build, the more traffic there will be. Also, there are about 1,000 deaths a year directly related to air pollution in Leicester. Now, if I were the mayor and I was serious about cleaning up the air and creating a better living environment, I would use that £7 million to create a free public transport system, or a free or heavily subsidized, leave your cars at home. This is now a pedestrianized, walkable city. It is green, it is pleasant, etc., and everybody can breathe. Failure to do that makes him guilty of genocide in my book. I mean, every year 1,000 people die of his policies.
Ken Livingstone, the Labour mayor of London, twice, or I think maybe even three times, he wanted to do exactly the same in London in the 1980s to create, using a small subsidy from the rates, as it was at the time, I suppose it'd be the council tax now, everybody in London paying into a little pot, which would have created free public transport in London. That is to say, free buses, free tubes, free trains within the London area. And actually, the thing is, the public transport in those days was publicly owned and cheap. And so it wouldn't actually have been at all an impossible thing to do. But he was then stopped through the courts from doing it. So you do wonder, don't you, what on earth is going on? Because that would be a brilliant way of just, people would then voluntarily wish to sell their cars if they weren't doing lots of journeys outside the town. And other thing is, in somewhere like Leicester, whenever you've got a place that's got lots of congestion, actually Bristol for many years has had problems with car congestion. It indicates that your public transport isn't working very well.
Exactly. But there are, you can even, you can go all out. You can have little tuk-tuks, like electric tuk-tuks or something, that literally, get people from Brislington in Bristol to Westbury-on-Trim, that's right across the city, for 50p, because it costs bugger all to do that. So people would actually leave their cars at home, what are those things called in India? Rickshaws. Can you imagine? Just lots of rickshaws in British cities.
Well, it's easy to say this, but then, when it's raining, cold, wintry, you can't expect elderly people, for example, to be getting around the city by bike.
No. A tuk-tuk is a little car. It's not a bike. It's a little car, like a bubble car, but a taxi, by way of a taxi. But you can also you create, like in Latin America, the taxis are actually a hybrid public transport. So they pick people up en route. It's not strictly your taxi. You share it with people that are picked up en route. There's all kinds of possibilities. I'm sure there's plenty of creativity.
Well, they use the scooters, don't they? These little scooters in Bristol. A lot of people use those little electric scooters. But anyway, look, you're over in Leicester, aren't you? After this festival this weekend, as well, I'm sure you're doing all sorts of other things over in that part of the country. But look, the reason I really wanted to call you is because I know before you came to the UK, you were working as a journalist, weren't you, over in Holland?
Yes, I set out in life as a journalist. Then met my husband-to-be, who lived in America. So then I lived in the States for a couple of years, and then I came to the UK, and then I didn't like it here anymore. So then I went to live in Mexico, and, I've been all over the place. But journalism, and certainly research is what really floats my boat. And the story that you and I spoke about, you are a bit of an expert on Bilderberg. And of course, Bilderberg was set up by Prince Bernhard von Lippe-Biesterfeld, who was the husband of the Dutch Queen Juliana, and ne'er did a more corrupt piece of shit tread this earth.
He married into the Dutch royal family just before the start of the Second World War, didn't he? About 1938.
Yes, that's correct. In SS uniform. the Hitler salute. There are actually wedding photographs of Juliana, the Dutch queen, also making the Hitler salute at this wedding.
Yeah, it's easy to say. I mean, this is before the war started, though. So, I mean, it's, you know, we're kind of, in a way, twisting reality by saying, oh, that's a terrible thing to do. But in those days, there was, you know, there was no Second World War, and the Nazis were considered completely normal by many people as a bulwark against the enormous Soviet Union that was growing in the East.
So why was so? There was plenty to worry about even then, surely. There was plenty of indications that this was not a movement for greater democracy in the making, you know, obviously. Having said that, when the Nazis rolled into Amsterdam, a motorcade rolled into Amsterdam, the Dutch greeted it by throwing flowers, you know, bunches of flowers, because Holland was such a horrendous place in the 1930s. The Germans came with promises of healthcare, with promises of paid holidays for everybody. You know, the socialist part of the National Socialism was fantastic for its day. So they were welcomed in. Didn't last very long, but...
It's interesting, this concept, because we don't think much about this. But even in Germany at the time, when the Nazis arrived in power, they were loved, they were embraced, because society had been brought to its knees after World War One by the Versailles Agreement. And the German people were suffering from mass unemployment, mass starvation, hyperinflation, and things couldn't get much worse. Are you saying it was a kind of similar sort of situation in Holland?
No. What you're leaving out in between the First and the Second World War is the wool market, the Wall Street stock market crash, the crash of 1929 that brought about the Great Depression. And my grandpa, for example, my paternal grandpa, he became unemployed, and he was literally picked up off the street by the Dutch authorities for being poor, for bringing down the tone of the country. And he was transported to a work camp, and my grandma and her children didn't know where he was for a long time. It was just for being poor, you know, just go be in the east of the country where nobody sees you.
Yeah, I suppose the lesson from this is that we must beware of any kind of mass economic problems, because literally this creates a kind of red carpet for the next dictator in the future. But anyway, just going back to your journalism, what about Bernhard then?
So I worked, I grew up in the city of Rotterdam, and my very first journalism job was as an apprentice journalist. Literally, it was straight out of school when I was 18, with a big Rotterdam newspaper. And the editor of this newspaper, he actually lived in The Hague, where the Dutch, which is the seat of the Dutch parliament, and, you know, that's where all the political life takes place. And I think there was an American, what we'd call a parliamentary inquiry. They call it a grand jury or something hearing. It was called the Church Committee, and they were looking into practices of bribery by Lockheed and other defense contractors. And it was rumored in The Hague, it was rumored that a highly placed Dutch person had been mentioned in these secret hearings in America. So my boss, the editor, his name was Jan Prince. His surname was Prince. And he thinks, I want to get to the bottom of this. I want to hear what Lockheed's got to say about this. So he picked up the phone, phoned Lockheed, got to speak to a secretary of the a general manager.
There we go. This is a military aircraft manufacturing company, as well as they were making airliners and things like that too, weren't they, in the United States?
Exactly, exactly. And all the obviously Europe had been in tatters after the Second World War, so all the European countries had become big clients of, you know, and it was the beginnings of NATO, and so everybody was buying ordnance and, you know, defense material. So business was booming. And my boss, Jan Prince, he phoned the United States, he phoned Lockheed, and got to speak to the secretary, who said, "Oh, very sorry, the boss is out to lunch. I'll gladly take your number and I'll get him to call you back." So my boss says, "Sure, this is my number. Please tell your boss Prince called." And about 20 minutes later, the phone rings and there's the general manager or whatever he was, the, you know, the CEO of Lockheed, absolutely furious on the telephone going, "I told you never to use the public phones. I told you not to talk to people, blah, blah, blah. How could you not discuss?" And he just spilled all the beans about the bribing of Bernhard, the prince, not Jan Prince, the editor. And, this is how the story blew. And there was subsequently, obviously, in the Dutch parliament, there was this investigation, and he just got wrapped on the knuckles, really. You know, if you or I were to do something like that, take $1.1 million in bribes to use your influence to get purchasing contracts for the Dutch army, we'd be in prison. But this guy just got, oh, well, he was a bit careless with his contacts. He was overly trusting of the people that he knew. That was kind of the conclusion of the report. It's all whitewashing.
Yeah, it's interesting in a way. This is 1975 this took place. And the irony is that it was to do with a deal to purchase these Lockheed Starfighter jets, which weren't actually very good. In fact, the US Air Force bought a few of them, started using them. This is the Vietnam era. And realized that they had this tendency to fall out of the sky because the wings were too small. Basically badly designed. And so I imagine in a way, Millie, it might have been that they'd manufactured these jets and the US Air Force was starting to turn their nose up at them, and they were looking to foist them off onto some, European power, maybe.
European power. Yeah. After Bernard died, it also came to light that he also took bribes from Northrop, which was another aeroplane manufacturer. And the corruption actually goes further, because, first of all, he denied absolutely everything, although there was plenty of evidence. There were letters between him and Lockheed. There were bank accounts that belonged to his stepfather that the money had been paid into, etc. But he claimed that any money that he'd received from any corporation was going to the World Wildlife Fund, which he was also set up, and
along with the Duke of Edinburgh.
Exactly. And there's a whole story of him selling two works of art at Sotheby's, I believe, or Christie's, by the by, for the sum of 2 million, is it Dutch guilders or was it pounds? I don't know. But basically, these paintings weren't worth very much at all. This money is supposed to have gone to the World Wildlife Fund, but really, it was a huge tax deal for Bernard and Juliana. There was like it was a tax scam, basically. The World Wildlife Fund he used to set up these reserves in Africa, particularly in Tanzania, supposedly himself and other rich people could freely enter there and go trophy hunting. And also he hired a private army. That's it. With the sale, with the sums raised by the auction of these paintings, he actually paid a private army of mostly British mercenaries in Tanzania who became heavily involved in the ivory trade themselves, not only in the illegal ivory trade of rhinoceros and elephant, but also they became involved in massacring black communities in then apartheid South Africa.
Well, I mean, there was, I think it was a book called The White Man's Game, which this is a few years ago now, maybe in the 1990s that came out, which was looking at the World Wildlife Fund really as an intelligence asset. The idea being that people would never suspect that, as you were saying, you know, money donated to them was used for the ivory trade, to actually foster the ivory trade, to use private armies in Africa to harass regimes that weren't friendly to the European powers. I mean, we even saw in the 1960s, didn't we, the assassination of the UN Secretary General by European interests, who was down there trying to sort out some sort of private army that had probably been financed by Bernhard or somebody else similar. The World Wildlife Fund with the panda logo, I think people need to understand this was a Western tool to just carry on colonialism, and in fact in a rather more sneaky and wicked fashion. But the other side of Bernhard's embarrassment in 1975, taking this $1 million bribe from Lockheed, was that he was then no longer able to chair the Bilderberg conferences, which had been going on by them for 20 years. And I mean, the Bilderbergers, I would characterize them as a kind of political lobby for NATO. So in other words, you know, the NATO interests, the military interests, want to make sure that they're going to get politicians in the European countries and in the States and Canada that, foster their interests, rather than, you know, maybe somebody like Jeremy Corbyn doesn't really fit the bill. So what do you make of the Bilderbergers? Because their origin is in the Bilderberg Hotel, just near Arnhem.
Exactly.
What do you make of this phenomenon? Because it's essentially a Dutch thing, isn't it? It certainly started in Holland.
Yeah. So let me just add that. So my former boss, Jan Prins, I actually stayed friends with him until his death. He always reckoned that the 1.1 million bribe had in reality been CIA money that should be used to counter the Cold War. So as you mentioned, Germany was kind of in between Russia and Europe. I don't know that I necessarily believe that, but so Bilderberg, I wouldn't have connected Bilderberg to NATO personally. I imagine Bilderberg to be a little club of megalomaniacs who want the world for themselves, you know, like the ultimate evil, like what's his name in the Pink Panther films, Dreyfus, Inspector Dreyfus, who wants to rule the world. And I think there is in my book, it was always just a club of the 200 richest people in the world who came together to discuss what they wanted. And I think NATO is their tool, not the other way around.
Well, maybe. I mean, it certainly is from the NATO countries that they were picked right from the start. They're not allowing anybody in really who isn't already part of that club. And also, you know, there are some people that go along to these Bilderberg conferences. They seem to be trying to schmooze them, like Will Hutton, who was the editor of The Observer back in the 1990s, wrote a piece in the paper which has now been forgotten and probably erased from most of the newspaper cutting libraries, which was very critical, calling them the high priests of globalization. So I think they're more trying to schmooze and almost like assess people to see whether they're but I mean, you know, I think your expertise a lot, I think, is on the side of just sort of Dutch culture and Dutch politics. How powerful do you think the Dutch are still? Because, you know, the Dutch have for many years kind of rivaled the Brits in Europe as a powerful maritime power, and particularly to do with the field of trade. So, you know, what do you think is Holland's role these days?
I think, first of all, Tony, I think I saw a guest list of NATO maybe 10 years ago, and there was definitely presidents of Chinese banks on there, and surely China is not in NATO. So,
look, they do have occasionally, they'll have Chinese people who are really, they're not from the Chinese government. That what they are is the NATO and the Western European. I mean, often they have, for example, Carnegie Foundation representatives in China. They may have a Carnegie Foundation person from Russia, for example, but they're not really representing those countries at all. They're representing the Western interests in those countries. Yeah. And that's only occasional. It's mostly just NATO interests that are there.
There was a member of parliament, a Dutch member of parliament, who asked a question in the lower house about the Dutch prime minister of the time, Balkenende. He was called Jan-Peter Balkenende. He had attended, the prime minister had attended the Bilderberg conference that year. And his member of parliament said, had the prime minister attended in a private capacity or in an official capacity, and if it was the latter, would he please report back to the lower house exactly what takes place there? Well, he lasted another week, this member of parliament, and then he was stripped of his constituency and his, you know, his role in the lower house. Like, you do not talk about Bilderberg in Holland. It's a hugely secretive society still. There are very specific channels that you have to go through, even as a student, even when you're 18 years old, you have to start trying to enter onto these paths to become a politician, to become a member of, you know, a future government, etc. And it's very much a cliquey, a cliquey society.
Well, I mean, it does seem very control freaky in Europe, in the, particularly in the EU these days. What do you make of the European Union and the Dutch? Because I, when I was over there doing my talk, I think it was 2018, there's definitely, I mean, maybe it's just because of the subject matter that I was doing, which is the origins of the Bilderbergers and Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann's involvement in you know, and the Second World War battle in Arnhem, and because I think that's why the meeting started in Oosterbeek, just outside Arnhem, is because of the sort of in joke really that
the spy who leaked Operation Market Garden, I forget his name, he was actually close friends with Bernard. And Bernard's own role, or rather the role of the Dutch monarchy in the Second World War, is just deplorable. First of all, they scarpered, you know, leaving the Dutch people. And they say it all came as a total surprise that the Netherlands got invaded, because in the First World War, it stayed neutral. And in fact, in the run-up to the Second World War, the Dutch were talking about, no, the Germans are our brothers, you know, we're all Germanic people, we're all one people, they won't invade us. Well, somehow or other, miraculously, the Queen and 40 million guilders of her assets, I mean, that's a vast fortune. Can you imagine? 40 million in 1940. Somehow they were ready to escape on the 10th of May when the Germans bombed Rotterdam. That is just amazing, isn't it? How they had that foresight to be ready.
Well, the guy anyway, you're Bernard, talking about, is just to remind you, is Christian Lindemans, or King Kong. He was the spy. And I didn't realise that he was quite so close to Bernhard.
Yeah. And Bernard supposedly engaged in diplomacy. He did all kinds of things during the Second World War. But basically, in a nutshell, the Dutch royal, so Queen Wilhelmina was in London, while Crown Princess Juliana, who was the wife, the future, the Crown Princess and the wife of Bernard, she and her children had gone to Canada to be well out of harm's way. But Bernard was all over the place. He was flying between Washington and Germany, between, Paris and London. So his role is really obscure, but I don't actually have any proof for this, I should say, but I hazard a guess that because what the Dutch did, the Dutch queen in London, Wilhelmina, she basically sat on the fence till 1943, telling the Dutch people to collaborate with the Germans, lest the infrastructure be damaged, or, you know, just collaborate, just do as they ask. Just the Dutch railways actually got paid a guilder of 50, which again was a vast fortune in 1940, for the transport of every Jew, one guilder 50 for every Jew that got transported. Vast fortunes were made in the Netherlands. Schiphol Airport was built with Nazi money. Anyway, that's all by the by. But the Dutch monarch said, collaborate until 1943. That's when Italy was invaded and the pincer movement, you know, was beginning to take place. So they were coming up through Italy and then later the D-Day landings. And it was only at that point that the Dutch queen started to say, now start resisting and told the Dutch railways to go on strike, and the Germans retaliated viciously, like literally starved the Dutch. As you know, in 1944, all the food was just removed from Holland for the German army, and the Dutch people starved.
Yeah, this is what they call the hunger winter. Must have been absolutely horrific. And the people who were throwing flowers over the Nazi convoys when they entered a few years before must have been really rather regretting that.
Yeah, people were literally, well, the stories are that people walked like 200 kilometers for a pram full of potatoes. You know, they would surrender their Rembrandt paintings for a loaf of bread. It was those are the kinds of stories. Anyway, I hazard a guess that the role of Bernard was to already put into place the future EU. So this is where I go towards your previous question. What's my feeling about the EU? I think that the Nazis were actually convinced to put down their weapons because their manifesto would be enacted anyway, because it was in everybody's interest to have a single European patent office, to have a single European currency, a single European language. That was in very much in the interest of IG Farben, which was the conglomerate of petrochemical and pharmaceutical companies that more or less bankrolled and prompted the Second World War. You know, so Bernard, I think, brokered that deal, said to the Germans, just, you know, put down your weapons, lose the war, and what you want will happen anyway, because everybody wants this. That's what I think.
Yeah, maybe right. I mean, I spoke to some people when I was in Holland who were saying, well, this is older people saying, well, at the end of the Second World War, the wrong people took over, saying that many of the people that were running Holland after the war, immediately after the war, had been the Nazi collaborators.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think I mentioned to you a talk by Matthias Rath, who's a fierce critic of, well, both his own country, Germany, and the EU. And he has done an extensive amount of research into the origins of the EU. So the Netherlands became part of the Benelux, which is Belgium, Netherlands and Luxembourg. So that was the very seedling of the European Union was Benelux. And then Benelux became European Economic Community. So France and Italy and Germany joined, if I'm not mistaken. So now it's six countries. And that then grew into what we now know as the European Union. But actually, you know, Nazi war criminals were fetched out of jail to become, you know, the presidents and what have you of this European economic community. Is bizarre.
Well, also integrated into NATO. I think the Soviet Union, Moscow must have been looking over saying, well, hang on a minute, what's the difference between this and what we were fighting a few years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel much the same. I feel there are so many lobby groups in the European Union. Undoubtedly, there are politicians in there who mean well and who truly believe their remit. But if you look at a lobby group like Codex Alimentarius, for example, which is the lobby of the food and health industry together, I believe, they lobby in the guise of food safety standards and, you know, medicine safety standards, this sort of thing. But really, they are there to drive organic food off the shelves, to drive alternative practitioners out of business. I mean, they are clearly, you know, there to promote genetically modified organisms, the bee killing pesticides of Bayer, you know, land grab, all this kind of thing. And not at all what they purport to be. So this is where my hate of hypocrisy comes in. Like, I see these people for what they are, and I don't want to live with it. So in the Netherlands, for example, foraging was made illegal in 2014. You get fined if you get caught picking blackberries, because it's unsafe to pick wild food. You have to buy it in the supermarket. You know, if you grow tomatoes in your backyard, you have to pay tax on them because you deprive the state of VAT on shop-bought tomatoes.
My God. I mean, that's unbelievable. I mean, they're now also talking, aren't they, about trying to ban wood-burning stoves, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I know. I know. You need a chimney license, actually, in Holland. You need a license to have fires in your own house.
Oh, God. Well, anyway, I know you're over in Leicester. Can you tell us what's going on there, please?
During the pandemic, I was stranded in Portugal, and I just would like to mention that I had the enormous privilege of meeting one of the heroes of the pandemic, who was this Portuguese judge. I don't know if you ever saw this little clip of a judge telling off a policeman, saying, "You do not tell me to wear a mask. You don't know who I am. You don't speak to people like this." Did you see that little clip? He was a Portuguese judge who was completely awake to all the crap that was the nonsense that was taking place. He put his judicial team to work to quash COVID fines. Anybody who got fined could send their paperwork to him, and his team would just annul it. He went around all the barrios, all the neighborhoods in Lisbon, talking to people about what hoax this was, encouraging people not to take the vaccine. He was just remarkable, this man. But anyway, meanwhile, in Leicestershire, another hero showed his hand. His name was Bill, and he was the landlord of the Dog and Gun pub in Syston, and he was a common law man, and he became involved in springing people from quarantine hotels that were more like, 10-day, 2-week prison camps where people didn't get fed, and just horrendous stories came out of these quarantine hotels. In any event, to cut a long story short, Syston became a kind of hub of resistance where everybody, like from Leicester, they would all go to the pub in Syston, which wasn't officially functioning as a pub. It was just where people came together and had a good time. But this is being carried on now. The work is being carried on by people, and there's talks about. So this weekend is a whole festival in. As a logical consequence of what happened during the Troubles. So this weekend there are talks by people, a retired doctor on how to get the vaccine out of your system. I think that's one of the talks on the program. There's talks. We all talk amongst ourselves about creating a new political system. What are the possibilities? Why are we all stuck in this paradigm of just thinking all we've got to vote for is these people and the color of their tie rather than, something that's actually meaningful to the country in a democratic sense? How can we reform the political process? How can we reform the financial process? Can we barter? Can we, what can be done? So there's all kinds of really, really interesting talks. And then there's absolutely fabulous music, all local Leicester music. Leicester, of course, has always had a very lively music scene. And this continues. So I'm really looking forward to the festival all weekend, Freedom Fest in Syston.
Yeah, so if people want to have a look online, you can get tickets. £10 a night, something like that. It's not too much anyway. Yeah, it's frpromotions.co.uk is the website for it. Weekend tickets £22, as you say. List of speakers is Ian Jarvis, Dr. Joe Whittaker. I mean, he's talking about EMFs and 5G. How to say no to Big Pharma, says Dr. Joe Whittaker. AJ Roberts, a popular podcaster of the human experience. And also, Keep It Cash. Debbie Hicks is going to be there, who we interviewed a couple of weeks ago about having her bank account shut down. Jasmine, the voice of the awake youth, always good fun when she's giving a speech, when she talks about the greedy people, and those are the ones we've just got to get rid of, the greedy people, and if you don't do that, everything else is just going to get worse. Very, very simple message. It'd be nice to hear Greta Thunberg talking about things like that, but she never seems to for some reason. And then there's also stuff about allotments and survival gardening, this sort of thing. But anyway, sounds like a great little event. But anyway, what about you, Millie? Can people follow your work online or on social media, that sort of thing?
Very little, really. I think I've earned my spurs as an anti-fracker. Also during the pandemic, my bus that we talked about earlier, is a 7.5-ton Mercedes Vario. It's about 8 meters long. And, when I returned from Portugal, finally, when the borders opened, finally, I booked myself onto a ferry from Santander to Portsmouth, and they wouldn't let me travel with my legitimate mask exemption. I mean, I wouldn't have worn a mask, but I am actually, I've got really serious emphysema, so I'm legitimately mask exempt. And they were going to lock me in a cabin for 28 hours. That's literally what they said. We have to protect our other passengers and we're going to lock you in the cabin. So that got right royally got my back up. But I'd already decided to do a bit of a Dolores Cahill, who was, I don't know if you remember her. She was traveling all over the place and just, I don't know, intimidating people with her knowledge of the GDPR and the human rights and insisting on traveling. So I did this too. I rocked up in Santander without a PCR test and without a passenger locator form and just claimed my human right to travel like the freeborn person I am. And they said, no, you can't travel. And I said, well, they said, you may have corona. And I said, well, you may have syphilis, but I'm still standing here talking to you. And anyway, eventually I said, well, look, you know, I'm not doing anything invasive to my body at all, but I am getting across that pond. So how about, would it satisfy you if I did 10 days of quarantine? And they said, yeah, 10 days of quarantine would do. And I went, okay, I'll do it right here. And I shoved my bus in front of the entrance to the port, hoisted the quarantine flag and went, see you in 10 days, fellas. I'm getting on that ship. And, of course, that didn't last very long. But anyway, it was nice to try. It was a laugh, I suppose. But
so what happened? No, no, come on. You know, what you're doing, it sounds to me like you're almost like kind of blocking the port entrance.
I did.
In your quarantine. So what happened?
Well, in the UK, so I was relying, I'd always, before you do a protest, so I had planned this very carefully because I knew exactly what they were going to say. I had tried to consult Spanish lawyers. In the UK, we always consult a lawyer before we do an action, like, you know, what do I make myself open to? Is this, for example, if you do an action at an airport or inside a ferry port, you commit offences under the Terrorism Act. Whereas if you do it on the public road, it's just a, you know, a summary offence. So you need to really know your law before you do something like that. So I'd chosen to be on the public road and not on port ground. And so in the UK, there's a law that says that you cannot move a vehicle with people in it or on it. So in the anti-fracking world, lorry surfing is one of our best weapons. You climb onto a lorry and you just sit there and all the traffic stops and the convoys can't get into the fracking site. Not so in Spain. Another law, a vehicle with a quarantine flag, you do not approach. That's international law. You know, somebody flies a quarantine flag, you leave well alone. Anyway, within about half an hour, something like seven different police forces had arrived, like 60 or 70 police were all mulling about around my van. And they were getting increasingly frustrated that I wouldn't obey their barked orders. And I just kept saying, no, this is a protest. And they said, where's your license to protest? And I just burst out laughing, like, you do not define what a legitimate protest is, you know. Anyway, they sent for a tow truck. And then the tow truck arrived and they all clapped. And the tow truck took one look at my bus and went, no way, and turned around, which is a really funny moment. And anyway, then they got increasingly frustrated and they started getting so violent. And after 2 hours, they were pointing guns and they were shouting they were going to break my bus windows and drag me out through the broken glass. And I'm like, whoa, this is way more violence than I'm in for. So that's the point where I withdrew and went, you know, this, I'm a peaceful protester. And ultimately, my argument was with the ferry company and it developed into an argument with the police. And you're never going to win an argument with the police. So anyway, I came back to Britain and
did you have to do the quarantine time?
No, not at all. They actually banned me from their ferries for 5 years. So I'm still banned. They still send me marketing blurb, but I can't actually book a ferry with them. And the next nearest ferry operator was in Dieppe in northern France. So I had an additional 1,200 kilometers to drive to get to a ferry port. And then I faked a PCR test, which I say quite proudly and openly, faked a PCR test, got on the ferry and came home. And then, of course, in Britain, you still had to quarantine. But we had means for that, too. And I don't know if people are aware, but there was a vast underground of, document forgers, and, you know, there was all kinds of ways and means of thwarting the rules and guidelines that were in place.
Well, I personally think the same is true for the elite, that they were having maybe placebo jabs rather than real vaccines, people who are on the inside and in the know. And, they seem to be able, certainly, for example, people like high court judges were traveling the world while everyone else was locked down. So, I mean, it seems to be one rule for them and another one for us. They had, they seem to be sort of, you know, cocking a snook at the whole world, saying, well, this is just a little game we're playing with you.
Yeah, totally. And it was so blatant. You know, like Bill Gates went on a lightning tour of European heads of state. There are photographs of him, shaking hands with Mark Rutte in the Netherlands and whoever, I can't even remember who was in Germany, but with Macron. And I'm like, how come he's not wearing a mask? How come he gets to travel? You know, how come these heads of state are just freely shaking hands with this man who's, not in anybody's bubble? And obviously I knew the answers to that, but nobody seemed to be asking these questions.
Okay. Well,
you know, and the Christmas parties came out in Westminster. The one pertinent question was, how come they weren't afraid? How come they freely partied? Mm. You know, it wasn't, were they breaking corona rules or not? No, it was, why weren't they wearing masks? Why weren't they socially distancing? Why weren't they scared?
So anyway, look, finally, Millie, what do you think's the way out of all of this? Because a lot of people seem to almost be, you know, increasingly depressed by watching the news, by listening to the radio and not on the mass media. Where's the light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, goodness. Where's the light for humanity? I think it's in humanity itself. It's just having a heart as big as you can possibly manage, taking care of your loved ones, forming community. This is the key. Form community. You know, figure out amongst yourselves what your skills are, who will support who, you know, who can babysit, who can tile, who can service cars, whatever. If the whole system implodes, which I am very much expecting, make sure that you're safe. Make sure that you can grow food somewhere, that you have an allotment or a piece of land. You know, just learn skills, learn all kinds of things yourself. Make sure you're as self-sufficient, you and your community, as you possibly can. I think that's the only way forward. And just let the financial systems implode. And, you know, let's hope that the phoenix rises from the ashes in better shape. I don't know what else to say. I don't have much words of hope. For me, I've seen this coming ever since I moved to the United States in the 1980s when I was only 20 years old. And I looked at it agog and went, well, but this is a bubble. Sooner or later, somebody's going to come with a drawing pin and it's all going to go pop, you know. And it has several times, but each time it's kind of been, you know, oh, the bank's been bailed out, or oh, this has been prevented, or whatever. But I think we're there now, and I'd say let's welcome it and build something better from the ruins of it.
Yeah, well, the challenge is, because of course the other side is planning to do that as well, so is to make sure that it's our version rather than their version. Anyway, look, Millie, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome, Tony. Thank you for interviewing me. It's been nice to talk freely. It's very refreshing to talk freely. And hope to see people in Syston this weekend.
In Leicester. Okay, thanks very much for joining us.
Bye, Tony.